For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
My name's Jeff Gordon. Like I was saying, it's pretty amazing that you stuck around for the last afternoon of the last day, and especially for something like this. And some people think, well, you know, this whole issue of generosity or stewardship, what's the big deal? Well, I think it's really, when it comes to church leadership, it's the real test of leadership. Are you really able to lead in this kind of an area? And this is an issue where I feel like as a church we've learned some things, and that's why even at this conference we were talking more about home groups. We felt like it might be important to share some of our experiences with the rest of those that came to this conference, just so you could benefit and we could probably learn, because we got a lot of help in this area over the years. Let's just start with a word of prayer. Lord, thank you that you are the God of the universe, and when it comes to our lives and when it comes to this issue of church finance, we believe where you lead, you provide. And that when you're leading the church into ministry that is costly, that you will provide the burden in people's hearts to fund that ministry. And Lord, I think it's that kind of conviction that you've shown us over the years, and I pray that you would use this time to just give others a sense for how they could lead in their church, in their personal lives. I know there are several people here in our church, and we want to be able to lead other people into generosity, because we know it's when they are giving that their life means something. If we're just hoarding everything for ourselves, our life turns out to be just this selfish mess. And we don't want to live that kind of life. So, Lord, I thank you for the way you've shown us these things. We want to continue to pray for Stuart Briscoe. Thanks that so many people are concerned for him. Thank you that I believe you did intervene there and help get him taken care of the way he needed to be. And we pray for his travels back to Chicago today, that all that would go well. Amen. I know a lot of people probably wonder what's going on with Stuart, and I think they probably mentioned last night, somebody told me, I'm a physician, so they called me out to go see him and stuff, and we took him down to the hospital because of a few things. He's had some medical care recently, and these were some complications probably related to that. But he's fine now. He spent the night in the hospital down at Riverside, and they released him this morning, and he's going to fly back to Chicago to join up with Jill. So that's good. He's probably going to have some things figured out still, so you can keep praying for him. I'm sure he'd appreciate that. But he's so gracious to all the, you know, everyone he meets. He's just the kindest sort of guy. He's an amazing person. So anyway, I hope I can be that kind of a person someday. All right. Well, let's talk about leading generosity. And I'm going to give you a few general thoughts that I think would be applicable to just any particular issue of generosity within your church or your personal life. But then I'm going to talk specifically about how we did a capital campaign. Here last fall, we had a campaign with a goal to raise $5.4 million or something like that, $5 million, and we ended up raising $7.4 million in this campaign. So it was a success, and we learned from a lot of other people in there what they taught us about their campaign, so we thought we'd just tell you a little bit about that. And like I mentioned earlier, is there have been many changes in this whole area in thinking. Did everybody get these booklets and whatnot, and the handout and some of these booklets, because I'm going to refer to these booklets and this newspaper. Maybe Joe can pass them around. Well, we track by attendance. We don't have a membership per se, but our weekly all-member attendance is around 5,000. Yeah. Okay, all member, all people attending. Okay, so I guess if you're doing a membership per se, it might be bigger. It depends. Everybody defines membership different. Okay, In the late 80s, we had some real problems that spilled over into the 90s in this whole issue of generosity, stewardship, and these kind of issues. First of all, it was something that we barely mentioned. We didn't take a collection at our meetings. We had a box at the back and said, you know, basically, you know, if you really think this is something you want to do, you can give. We didn't have many expenses, so it really wasn't that big of a deal. But here's the biggest problem that I think God raised for us is that we did not appreciate the spiritual value of generosity. That giving is part of spiritual growth, and if you're going to grow spiritually to become a generous person is part of it. You can't really be a selfish, hang on to everything for myself kind of person and be loving. They just don't fit together. And so that is probably what's gotten our biggest attention. And the result was is that we didn't fund our ministries and we weren't growing spiritually like I think God wanted us to. We had periods when we were just way behind on our budgets. We had plans to build this one building on some property that we had down by the Calumet School. We had these plans. And we rolled out this capital campaign, and it totally flopped. It's like nobody was into it. It was, and as we look back, you know, it was poorly conceived, it was poorly communicated, and it was poorly received, you know. So everything about it was bad. And God, you know, was just kind of like saying, all right, guys, you got a lot to learn in this whole area of how to lead in the area of generosity. So the biggest breakthrough in our thinking came with this whole idea, and for a lot of you, for most of you who read your Bible and you're spiritual people, this is probably wasn't, it's not really a breakthrough, but generosity is a spiritual issue. It's not a peripheral issue. It's meaningful. In fact, it's probably central. I think we sort of stuck to the adage, the wallet is the last thing to be sanctified. A lot of people say that, and there's probably a certain truth to that, but it's not the last thing you're ever going to get to. For one thing, everything is always sanctified. He says that he who began a good work in you will perfect it until when? Until you're totally sanctified? No, until the day of Christ Jesus. So it's an ongoing process of change that comes about in a person. And what we believe, the Bible says, and I think what we undersold or underbelieved, if you want to use that term, is how important it is to be a giver. Because really, when it comes down to it, and a message that we have tried to make clear through this campaign and in our church, is that there are givers and there are takers in the world. You know, there are people that all they want to do is take as much as they can get. They want to, what can the church give to me? What can you do for me? What am I going to get out of this if I invest in it? You know, that's not the mentality of a giver. That's the mentality of a taker. And so what we want to have is a church full of givers, people who are intent on giving themselves, of sacrificing for others, sacrificing for something that's greater than them. Some other important points that I think we learned is that, one, people are really serious about their money, aren't they? I mean, this is their hard-earned money, and the way our culture looks at it is that it's yours to do what you want with it. You bought it, and there's not kind of a sense that everything you have is God's. And that's something that people have to learn and have to really buy into, is this idea that I am a steward. And that God has given me this, and it's about how I use what He's given me. It's not how much of my money I give to God, it's how much of God's money I keep back for myself. See, it's a whole different way of looking at the reality of personal finance. And we realize that people are real serious. And if you're going to call on people to sacrifice and give, you better have a good investment for them. And you better show them that there's return on their dollar, spiritual return. They're not just going to give to something that is not making progress, at least not in a sacrificial way. They may just peel off a few bucks here and there. But to really dig deep and sacrifice, it's got to be something that's meaningful. But we also find this, and I think all of you know it, that people gain great satisfaction and they grow when they give. And I guess this is something that's changed my whole heart on how I teach about giving, how I counsel about giving, when I pray with my disciples about their giving, the real conviction that their life will be better if they give. And it's a completely different way of looking at it than thinking they need to give, or there's a certain amount they have to give, or, you know, there's an obligation kind of view of giving, and then there's this other view that this person's life will be substandard. They will not have the joy of the Holy Spirit in their life if they never learn to give. And so I guess that conviction has been life-changing for me. And we're actually, we did this campaign, but we have a school that we're trying to fund down in South Linden, and we're also going into the community, and we're talking to people that aren't members of our church, actually trying to raise $1 million outside of the church for this $3 million project. And I met with a guy who's been a friend of mine. He's a physician. He's probably not a Christian, but he was interested in this project. And so he went down and he went on a tour with me. And this is down in the urban area, predominantly African-American, almost 99% African-American community. This is where most of the kids grow up in single-parent families. I think over 90% don't have a father in the home. It's got all the problems of the urban setting. The school performances are terrible. But we started this school down there about, 7 years ago with kindergarten, and have added a grade, and they're really making a difference. So I took him down, and we visited this school. And he saw these kids learning, and the third grade teacher down there knows Chinese, and he's teaching these African-American kids. They were conversing in Chinese in this class. He was showing them things. They went through their phonograms, the kindergartners, all their phonics. The older kids were going through the parts of speech. They have a way of going through sentences where they break it down. And by the end of this thing, he was practically in tears. He couldn't believe. And it was striking to him, the commitment of the teachers. A lot of these teachers have moved from the suburbs, and they live in that community now. And I stopped and met with him last week. It was about a week after. And he says, you know, I decided to give, and his hand was almost shaking. And he says, you know, I've never given this much money to anything before. And he had this big smile on his face. And, he gave $10,000. And he was glad, and he says, and I want to give more. And he says, I've never seen something where it was making a difference. You know, everybody's after your money, but here it's a difference. You see, and in him, he did something he had never done before. He was a cheerful giver. You know, Paul says in 2 Corinthians 8 that God loves a cheerful giver. And the way that you become a cheerful giver is that you believe that it makes a difference and that God is in this. And I think him, as a person investigating, he realized that this is of God. And he wanted to get behind it. You see, so here's this guy with all this money will never have the satisfaction that he could from what he has if he doesn't learn to give. He'll never have it. And so it's a whole new burden that I think God has developed in me for helping people learn to give. It's because it's changed my life so much, being able to learn how to give. So if we think of generosity as a spiritual issue, which it is, how are we going to approach it? Well, if this is the case, how do you help people grow in generosity? And I just throw back the question then, well, how do you help people grow spiritually? What are the things that you're going to help them with? How do you help people grow spiritually? So if somebody says, well, I want to grow in my, pick a spiritual discipline, in my prayer, what are you going to do? You're going to say, well, you know, you need to pray. That's all there is to it, you know. Pick a time, pick so many hours a day. You need to go and pray. You know, that would be stupid to just say, go pray. You know, it's just do it. Nike spirituality, I call it. Just do it. You know, that's not the way you're going to effectively work with somebody in any spiritual area. You're going to realize, first of all, that the Holy Spirit is at work, that we are filled with the Spirit, that God is at work within this person, that He is leading, and that He is giving direction to them. And since that's the case, that as a leader, I'm going to pray. I'm going to pray for this person. I'm going to pray that they get insight from God. You know, like Paul opens Ephesians, Philippians, and Colossians with very similar prayers, doesn't he? He says, the one in Ephesians, he says, I pray that the eyes of your hearts may be open, that you may have a spirit of wisdom and of revelation. You know, and I think that's what, in the area of generosity, that's what I want to pray for people, that God would open. This is too far beyond anything. We can't pry people's hands off their dollars, you know? This has to be a work of God, that He is the one that convinces them that there's a different way. And I think this is the main way. If you're going to teach somebody about prayer, you're not going to say just pray. You're going to pray with them. You're going to talk to them about it. But you're going to take them to the Word, aren't you? And say, here's what the Word says about it. This is how I think the Holy Spirit works in people's lives, is they develop biblical convictions. So if we think of the convictions to develop, here's the way I think it through. First of all, from the Bible, what is our mission? What is our mission? What is the church here to do? And it raises the question then, do people in the church know our mission? Do they know what we're here to do? Because when it comes to funding a ministry, we're going to talk about this a little bit in a capital campaign, that people don't want to pay the light bills. You know, they don't look at it like they don't want to build a building. They don't pay for bricks and mortar. They pay and they get behind and they love to support a mission. They support a vision. If the church is meeting God's call, and you got to embody that in your church, however that is. But if you're not convinced, and if the people in your church are not convinced that you're doing something that's meaningful, they're not going to pay for it. I wouldn't. You know, you want to pay for something, it's a good investment. He says that we should be wise investors. You know, and that's what we tell our people, you know, not just here, but you need to find other ministries to support and look carefully at them. Support the ones that are doing something that's good. And so when I think of our mission and the things that people want to support, is one is at the top is that we reach the lost. And so when we did our capital campaign, when we talk about our budget, it's all about, are we reaching lost people? And that's at the center. So when we need to expand, it's clear. The reason that we're going to do it is because it's in line with the mission that God has for the church. And if it's not, then it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard for me to argue the case to do it. You know, I just couldn't do that. And I'm just kind of summarizing our mission. You got to try to keep it simple. You know, we're reaching the lost, and we're really doing that through personal discipleship. That we make disciples. I summarize our mission is that we're becoming and we're making disciples of Christ. We're becoming, each of us are growing, and then we're making. As we're becoming and making disciples of Christ, we're fulfilling the Great Commission. But then there's another key element of, and I think this is central to the biblical mandates, and that is that we minister to the poor. And that the church is called, you know, I don't have time to develop a case for this. I could talk to you about it. I could give you stuff that I've written or others have written. But you go to the Old Testament and you read through the prophets, and one of the major critiques of the prophets against the kings and against the people of Israel is that they neglected the poor. You know, and Jesus loved the poor, and he was attracted. Jesus was poor, you know, in our estimates of wealth. You know, that Paul gave up everything, and there were periods of his life as he lived as a vagabond, when he went from, he was a riches to rags guy. And that the church is called to minister to the poor. Look what they did in the book of Acts. It says they sold their possessions and they had all things in common. You know, they cared about the plight of the poor. You know, the Proverbs say that if you neglect the poor, it's like you reproach your master. You reproach God. And so there's this biblical command, but then there's another key element to ministering to the poor, and that is that the church is the hand of God in our community. How else can this world see the love of Christ if he doesn't see it through the church? And the church and the people in our community, they're not going to look in here and say, wow, these people really love each other. I mean, every once in a while, some of them are going to come in, and that's attractive. It's winsome to the non-Christian to see the love of Christ in Christian community. But they need to see us in the community doing something that makes a difference, loving the poor, ministering to the poor, helping the dying, ministering to the AIDS patients. These are the things that the world takes notice and they says, I might be interested in that kind of a God that would do that sort of thing. So here at Xenos, we believe this is really important, both locally and throughout the world, that we give in significant ways, and not only we give, we develop strategies that are going to make a long-term impact in ministering to the poor. So when we think of our biblical convictions, that's our mission, this first part. But then there's this other biblical conviction that I think we need to build a case for, and that is that God calls us to be generous. There are so many ways that you can build this case. If you just read 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, we have our Christian ministry class. We do a whole week on building this case out of 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. You can get that on our website. But I guess I've talked about that. I've sort of built that case here today. But there's this other issue, and that is that it's good to sacrifice. That people have this innate drive to do something that is cool, that is awesome, that their life they can look back on and say, you know, I just didn't live just a regular life. My life was extraordinary. You know, there's this call, and it's because we're made in the image of God, and that there's this drive that he's put inside each of us. You know, and people in our world around us and us, We're driven by this world system to try to fulfill that call that God has put on our heart by accumulating wealth or finding prestige, having people look up to us or something like that. When what all people seek is the approval of God, really. And the knowledge that I laid down my life, that I took up my cross daily and followed Christ. And I think, an important way to embody that is giving. And giving in a sacrificial way. You know, I love 1 Timothy 4, verse 10, the New Living Translation. Some people like it, some people don't. I like its translation of this, and I think it's true to the text. He says, "We work hard and suffer much so that many people might believe the truth, for our hope is in the living God." We work hard and suffer much. You see, that's foreign to our culture. Our culture is one that's all about comfort. And I think the biggest mistake we can make is to shape our church life around the call for comfort. We can't provide as much comfort as their couch or their remote control or TiVo or a vacation home or a cruise. We can't compete with that. And we're not going to try to. What we're going to do is call them to virtue, call them to a higher calling, call them to sacrifice, because it's good. It amazes me how much people benefit when they begin to get this. But you know, you realize too, this is not going to happen in somebody's life overnight. It's not going to happen in your church overnight. This passage in Titus 3, verse 14, he says, "And let our people also learn to engage in good deeds, to meet pressing needs, that they may not be unfruitful." That this is a learned process. Jill Briscoe was saying, that it's one of these arts. It takes time. Learn to engage in good deeds, to meet pressing needs, that they may not be unfruitful. And then there's this other point, and that is that our church can model generosity. In other words, you can look at the church's books. Dennis was saying he liked to study other churches' budgets. Well, when you study a church budget, you can learn a lot. Just like you study a personal budget, you can learn a lot where their priorities are. And one thing that the church can do to help people see that they can give in faith is that the church can give their money away. Okay? So that we have a budget X dollars. Well, a certain amount of that we can give to others. We can give to the poor. We can give to missions. Okay? And that's something that we should talk. Not like we're bragging, but this is just a value. And this is something that we believe we want to grow in this area. But I don't know if you can see these, but our budget's around $5 million here at Xenos. And to our missions and to our ministry to the poor in South Linden, out of our general fund, we give about $833,000 goes there. So that's what, close to 15% of our general fund budget. But on top of that, then, individuals in Xenos support our missionaries to over $500,000. Then we do short-term trips. And the reason we put this in here is we believe that it's important to get people around situations of poverty. They get to touch and feel what people live like in the world. And so you could probably take that out of there because it's not really going directly to relief or missions. But then Urban Concern, which is our urban ministry, Xenos individuals support it to around $100,000. And then in the last 2 years, we've developed this humanitarian aid fund, which is something I think is really cool, because besides our budget, then this humanitarian aid fund goes totally to minister to the poor. And there's some here to our Urban Concern, but most of it goes abroad. We call it a heavenly mutual fund, because it's got these different ministries in it, and you're always getting deluged with stuff to give money, aren't you? This person, that person, and they all look pretty good, you know. They know how to put the good foot forward and seek the cashola. Well, these are ones that we've really researched, we visited, and we know the leaders, we watch their books. And so if people want to put their money into the Heavenly Mutual Fund, we know it's going to a good cause. So we've got the Humanitarian Aid Fund, and then our operations that we manage for Urban Concerns amounts to that. So it's about a total of around $2 million goes into missions and to the poor. Now, something else we did, this was at the end of, remember, in December of 2004 is when the tsunami hit Asia. And that year, God blessed us. We didn't spend our whole budget. We came in about $100,000 in the black that year. And that was the year we were coming up on our capital campaign. But we thought, out of faith, that money was needed. And we gave that whole $100,000 for tsunami relief. I think I just think it's the right thing to do when God provides for you like that. And it just speaks so much to the church then, to the people that say, you know, God's blessed me. Maybe I should give too. You know, this is the way we deal with our finances. And geez, I got a big expense coming up later in the year. Well, I'm going to provide for that too. You know, and that's what God did. He provided for the bigger one in a bigger way than we ever imagined. 50% more than we thought we'd get. So it's something to think about. So when it comes to building these convictions, how do you do it? Well, I think it's something that you just keep talking about a lot in the church. in your ongoing teaching ministry, and I'm not, and I don't mean necessarily just about generosity. I mean about mission. That people in your church know where you're going, and they see some of the tension that you know, why we can't get there. If there are certain barriers because of things that we don't have that we need to be able to put this together, but this is the place where you can. You have to keep your people online and thinking and engaged in where we're going, the ongoing teaching ministry. It's not like that we just talk about this now and then. I think that's the one advantage of expository teaching, because these issues come up in the text in a real natural way, and as long as you don't jump over them, you know, they're always, because if you read through the New Testament, man, you're going to read about finance, you're going to read about mission, you're going to read about the poor. It's going to come up a lot. So you just teach through the Bible, and you're going to hit these topics. Here at Xenos, we have certain classes where this comes up on a regular basis. We have a yearly pledge drive in January and February, and during that time, we give our home church leaders a recommended study that they can go through with their home church or in their men's or women's Bible studies. We do a yearly budget workshop. We have a team of financial consultants that do a personal budget workshop and try to help people see how they can incorporate their giving. There's a, it's called the Gift Ministry. You can look at it online. I think we have a long way to go on this. We're not really proactive. There's like Willow Creek up in Chicago started a thing called Good Sense, and it's very proactive. In other words, they take people through this, so they're thinking about it. And a lot of times in ours, people call up, you know, it's like 911. I'm broke, you know. Help. So we need to make some headway in this area, and I think we are. And then in your personal discipleship, that this if you really believe that it's a spiritual issue and that someone's growth and their contentment as a human is dependent on this, you're going to bring it up. You're going to pray together about it. Then at Xenos we have this we call it our fiscal support team. And our fiscal support team is made up of people who have committed to give at least 5% of their income to Xenos. And we say 5% because we think people should give more than that, but we want them to be able to support, like we have missions, we want them to support other ministries. We believe that, you know, there are a lot of other good places to invest their money, and they should diversify, so to speak. But as you're home church, you should give significantly there. But anyway, people that give 5% to Xenos can be on the fiscal support team, and we come together each year for a morning of presentations from all of our, we call them division coordinators. And the division coordinators talk about what happened in their division that year and what their plans are for the next year and how that will be funded. And then they have funding options. We call them modules. We can unpack this if you're interested. But the bottom line is the fiscal support team then, they vote on, one, how much will increase the budget. In other words, the percentage next year, 06 versus 05. We want to increase the budget 5%. In other words, we're ready to give that much more for next year. And then they vote on how we're going to spend it on these modules. There's certain base budget items that are in there, but any kind of new ministries, they have a vote in that. So the effect that it has is that the people then get to see whether this is something that they're really into, whether and I think God leads through the fiscal support team too into the ministries that He's behind. And the other thing is, from an elder standpoint, it sort of, you share the agony with the church. You know what I mean? The agony of having to say no to certain people. You know, because there's always a lot of good ideas. And what do you say? Well, this division coordinator, they've got a great idea, but so does this one. Which one are we going to choose? Well, then if the elders behind closed doors, they say, well, we'll take A and not B, then the people that were into B and not A, they're like, well, why'd you do that? You know? well, it was a hard decision. Yeah, I'm sure it was a hard decision. Well, the guy that got A, he liked it. Well, you share the agony. And all the church realizes there's a lot of good stuff that we can do, and some things we're going to have to say no to. But we'll all vote together on it. So it's really been an awesome thing. Yeah. Oh, well, I don't know. You can't always. We've never really had any major brawls there. We've had some brawls over the years, but not in that context. I think people come there. It's a big meeting. You know, this is like 400 people, 400 or 500 people, and so they make presentations, then people can ask questions or give support or speak against it. So we really haven't had much trouble with that so far, but. Mm-hmm. Or a student.
Okay.
Right.
And the second question is, if you're not pledging 5%, you don't have a say in the budget?
No. No. You don't get to vote. You get a say whether or not you give or not.
Yeah.
So you get that vote. Yeah. So, and we don't have people submit their 1040s or anything to know if it's 5%. But we do have a card that gives their pledge for the year. Like if they pledge $1,000 and say, well, so this means you made, what's that? That's 5% of like 20,000 or something. So this means you made 20 grand this year. You sign it. So, you know, they got to sort of look at that and say, am I going to lie about this? I know I made more than 20 grand this year. So then that's sort of helped the honesty factor with it, to help them realize that we know how to divide by 5%. What's that? No, if they fall behind, we just give quarterly reports, and then if they don't make their pledge, then it's just their honor whether or not they vote or not. Yeah, I mean if you want to have integrity, then you didn't make your 5%, and people say that, you know, I didn't make it this year, I couldn't, I won't vote, and we're gracious about that. That's good. We try to extol the person that has the integrity to take that kind of a stand. And then we try to help them, you know, get back on track. Yeah. No, I'm not going to, but I can a little bit. I don't know a whole lot about that. You mean debt for the church? Yeah. Well, let me keep moving here, and then we have till, what, 6 or 7? All right. Let me think here. The fiscal support team, yeah. Now here, I'm just thinking, how do you help people grow spiritually? We talked about the Holy Spirit, leaders praying, the biblical convictions, and I sort of wound that up with our mission, the convictions about mission, convictions about generosity. But I think this is, it's a spiritual issue. It's got to be a matter of prayer that you pray about when you're together. You pray about as your home, as a home group, if you have home groups when you meet, and you pray about it individually. And I'll tell you some of the things we did during our capital campaign to promote that. But then this feedback. I said for individuals, we send out a quarterly statement that just lets them know how they're doing. But we also then this statement goes out to our home group leaders, not the amount. The only people that know the amount that has access to it, and it's not like they even look at it, are the elders and the finance people. But our home group leaders, they just know for their home, members of their home church, whether or not they're keeping up. and that they can go to them again, and we try to help our leaders learn how to just do this in a gracious way and say, you know, how are things going with this? Are there things that we can pray about? Are there troubles that you guys are having financially? And try to help people along in the area of personal finance. I think the thing that we have to somehow overcome here is this ultra private view that people have of their finances, is that it's something that we need to be able to engage on. Otherwise, we're going to lose out on this key area of their sanctification. But the other thing that where you got to have feedback, and that is, and I think this is a lot more important than a quarterly report to somebody, and that is the church accomplishing its goals? That's what they're paying for, right? They're paying, they're committed, they're sacrificing to see the church grow, to see people reached, to see this mission fulfilled. And that's why it's so important, I think, to track the progress of the church. You know, because if we're not, what are we going to say? How are we going to, in any kind of convincing way, come before the church and say, you're making a good investment when you give to XYZ church? And so I think that's why it's really important to have key indicators of your mission, that you track those and that you talk about those and that people in your church know about them. We're succeeding or we're failing, and if we're failing, what are we going to do? Not that we're always succeeding, you know, but if we're failing, we need to at least say, well, at least let's pray about this. We need to have some plan to deal with it. So this kind of feedback, personal and feedback to the church about the mission. Yeah, Chris?
All right, so it's June, and sort of a halfway through the year, and you get this report, you check a percentage of how, okay, so let's say someone's just 10%. Like, do you approach them if it's a guy that you're studying with? And if it's not, if it's someone that someone else is studying with, because you're the leader, do you send that other person, or do you go because you're the leader?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Okay. I think it depends on the situation. Okay, that's where we've got to use our savvy and our discernment here. If it's somebody that's definitely just kind of on the fringes, and you realize this person, they're not really into following God right now, we got bigger fish to fry here, I wouldn't say anything. If it's somebody that I know is engaged in their spiritual life, that they're making headway, that this is something that, you know, you get the sense that we need to address, then you take it on. And I think there's kind of an expectation that our leaders and that's the approach that we take on it. Because, you know, certain people, if they're not engaged with God, then this is the last thing on their mind. But still, you know, that person, with the right kind of conversation, if God's got them in the right place, maybe this is the pivotal issue for them too. So I think that's why it's one that we need to really approach individually and prayerfully. I don't know if that was vague enough to.
Yeah. Well, the timing of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Do you ask people in the pledging to become accountable to somebody else other than the elders?
Yeah, you know, we don't recommend that explicitly, but I think it's a good idea, and I think in people that are in discipleship, those kind of issues come up. But I think that's the only thing I'd be reluctant about that is maybe somebody's not quite there yet. So as far as making a kind of a general recommendation or policy, but I think it's a good idea. Yeah. Yes.
I'm just curious. The 5%, is that sort of a minimum that you're looking at, or is it sort of doing wonderful? 5%?
No. No. We call that the starting point.
Okay.
We believe, I don't know if you've ever read Sider's book, Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. We believe in the graduated tithe, which, and that's why we don't teach the tithe, because we believe that 5% is the bare minimum and that people should be looking at way over 10%. That in this economy where, and the kind of wealth that we have, we don't look at 10% as the goal, or especially 5. The 5 is so that they can say, well, if we're going to get to 10, we want to be able to give to other things. Well, good. Now you can give, you can be at 10 and still give to other things, and then, but give more. Okay? Yeah. No, I think our guys have looked into that some, but that might be, I don't know that much about it.
I mean, dealing with, because it deals both with the debt that people have incurred, as well as giving, like the tithing, and getting people to deal both with their debt that's in their financial aspect, not just the tithing aspect of it, and take them beyond, and give them biblical principles as to how to manage their money, to ultimately provide them in the future to, say, give 15.
Uh-huh.
Because they set themselves up in a position where they've gotten rid of the debt, they've paid down debt, and they've also instilled the biblical principles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we talk a lot about debt and personal debt, but I don't know how effective it is. I just know a lot of people that are, you know, up to here in debt. So that's something we'll have to look into. Could you jot that down, Joe? Crown Ministries. Crown Ministries. This was like 90, what was it, 98? 99, something like that, yeah. Well, no. No, it's, our total debt's around, since we built the cafe, our total debt's around $2 million. Last year. Yeah. This site's worth about 8.5 to 10. So that, you know, we still have equity and we still have a cash buffer. And but God provided this site for us, this whole story. This there were 62 acres here, and it was in a bankruptcy court, and nobody could develop it. It sat here for years. And somehow we went to a sheriff's auction. We didn't win it. Another guy won the thing at an auction, but then he couldn't finance it. And he put up $50,000, like earnest money. He couldn't finance it. The bank came to us and said, if you guys can raise $1 million in like 6 weeks, we'll finance the rest of it. It was $2.5 million, I think, was the price. That's what it was, $2.5 million. And so the church came forward, who raised it. So we got it, and the guy that put his $50,000 earnest money went towards our purchase price. He didn't like that. But he knew that coming in. And then this Home Depot came in, and they bought like 6 acres for us at $250,000 an acre. That's $1.5 million. And then they did all the road improvements down at the light, which was another $500,000 it would have cost us. And then in the whole deal, we pulled off. We were looking at the plot, and one of the things they got, because the guy that owned the corner they bought, was the 1.5 acres that our building X sits on. We say, well, why don't you throw that in on the deal too? And so we got that piece of property. And so the whole net effect was this: we got this thing for like anywhere about $500,000 to $1 million, 62 acres at the corner, major. There's no plot like it inside the outer belt here. And so God just like, He handed it to us. And so it's one of those things that you never forget. And then when, because I still, when I walk around here, I can't believe it. I'm like this, I was just up, there's this, like this out, this lookout over this creek over here. And I was up there praying the other day, and I was thinking, how did you ever give this to this little church, this place to minister? It's just amazing. So anyway, I better keep going here. I'll babble on forever. Let me tell you about our capital campaign, because that may help you out some, and there's some certain principles here that we learned. Again, what people want to give to is a mission. They want your vision, and I think the vision should drive the plans for the capital campaign too. I think oftentimes you think, well, we have a certain budget to build to, my personal opinion is that what is the vision? What do we need to accomplish in this church? And then you think, what is the facility that we need to do that? And so then you plan for that, and then that's going to cost X dollars, and then you go and you raise that. So just, I would say, don't sell yourself short on your vision just because you think, well, we can only raise so much money. The most important thing is you're convincing that this is a good project, it's going to meet the needs, and that people will get behind it then. But the key is really then being able to communicate this to the church. And what you really need to do, I feel like, when it comes to this is you build tension, and this is what you do in any kind of leadership. In other words, there's a discrepancy here between the way the things are and the way the things can be. And this is not necessarily part of the capital campaign. This is the cultivating in the hearts of the people of this church that we can do better than this, that God has something for us to do, and things are going to have to change here to get to that point. And we're going to need certain facilities. And 9 months to it was almost a year before we started our capital campaign. And part of our capital campaign, it was kind of complicated, but part of it was to fund this school. And so, a year before that, we were saying, these kids are meeting in facilities all over Southland, and it's not safe down there. We really need to come up with a plan to build a school down there. And so there's this growing sense in the church. It's not like you just spring, surprise, we're going to raise, $5 million. The people have this sense that we need to do something. And you say, we're going to do a capital campaign. We got to put a plan together for it. We're working on that. And so that in the church, there's this building sense that they're going to be coming after me. And I wonder if it's going to be worth funding. A sound solution, a sound solution for the problem. For that problem, for the kids in South Linden, for the problem of growth. Here, another problem we had was for our campus ministry. We didn't, our lease was up on the property, we had outgrown the space down there. How are we going to solve these problems? And so that people have to look at your solution and believe that it makes sense and that it's doable. And then you have to create a communicate. How are you going to get all this information out? And like I said, for us, we had this really complicated thing. And one of the things we used was our Xenos News, but the problem, we called it the Investing, Building, Reaching campaign. And you see there are these three buildings on the logo. Well, that's the complication with our plan. We funded this expansion here, $2 million. We funded it was started out at just like 1.5 down on campus, or 1.8. I'm not very good with numbers like that. They're all in here. For a campus facility, and then $1 million for our facility in South Linden. And so it kind of compounded the whole communication on it, because you had to talk about how each one of these different projects were going to be good and meet the needs of the church. So with your communication plan, what you need is a real clear message, how this is in line with the vision. And what I would recommend on this is, if you have experts that are like communication experts in your church, and we've got a bunch of people that have done like fundraising professionally, or they're like PR people and that kind of thing, you bring them together and let them work on this together. Did you have a question, sir?
Yeah. Did you hire one then, an expert, or you have the expert here?
Well, for our campaign for our first facility, we hired someone, because we'd never done that before. In fact, we hired someone to help us run our campaign to raise funds outside of the church for our facility in South Linton. We have somebody on the hook right now for that because we've never done that before. So if you haven't done a capital campaign before, I think it's good to get a pro in. It's expensive, but you know, it's complicated and it takes a certain, there's certain things that they have you do that I never imagined that you would do. And what's that? We have a expert, they're called Hodge Kramer. They're local, they're working on our project right now. And the other was called Gettler and Associates. They're another local outfit. So but they helped us a lot with that first capital campaign.
Did you raise 7 million cash or was that pledges?
Pledges. Okay. Cash and pledges over 3 years. The cash up front was about $1.5 million that came in by year end last year. Yeah. And so this takes several months of planning to get something like this together, because I think that you really do, you need something simple. I think it's good if you can have kind of an identity for it, and that the leadership is together, the church is together. When you do your campaign, that everyone is committed to it. That's why we taught our teachings in our adults to our college students. They went right down into the high school level. Then everybody knows for this period of time, this is what the church is focused on because it's important. And so you get your communication experts, you figure it out, you work hard on it, and then when it comes to communicating these kind of things, again, these are just, I think, basic leadership principles when it comes to leading change, is you start with your committed people. And you go to them and you make your presentation and you just expect complete buy-in right away. Right? No. No, they're going to have a lot of questions. And you expect those questions. And you don't develop any kind of sense that if you're questioning my plan, you're questioning my leadership. You know, if we're that ego attached to it, then it ain't going to work. It's just not, that's not happening. Because people, thinking people, and that's who you want to have engaged here, that are willing to really put their lives down and then lead others on this, they're going to have questions. And so we're going to bring our opinion leaders together and we're going to interact with them on it. Here we have we call it our servant team. So the way this whole thing launched, and we'd been talking about this, and the servant team, they knew what was going on, but as we launched this campaign in the fall, we met with our servant team members, and then we told them about the whole strategy then for how we were going to run the campaign, and this was in late August. And if you look in here, there's a timeline that we followed. It's on page 3, right down here in the bottom, important campaign dates. I'll talk about this teaching series, but September 17th, that was a Saturday, and on September 17th is when we met with our servant team. So that was the day this thing officially launched. It was September 17th, 2005. So you start with your opinion leaders, and then you need to break it out, and I think through your opinion leaders, the word has to get out to the church. So what we did is we have this publication. We didn't. A lot of times you make a brochure. We did that last time, but we have this that comes out like once a quarter. So we just use the fall edition to talk about the campaign. So it worked out great because we could, you know, that way that people could read as much or as little of it as they wanted to. I guess they do with that with a brochure anyway. And I'll talk about then the other thing that we did, and really we got this idea, something that's really helpful, and I'm going to put up a slide at the end, but we went to a conference that Willow Creek put on called the Resource Challenge, and it's really well done, and they had a lot of speakers there, and Several talked about when they did a capital campaign, they did a teaching campaign as part of it. And so that's what we decided that would be a good idea for our communication plan. So we did a four-week series. And we did this in, again, all of our meetings, our adult and in our college meetings. And just to give you an idea of what we talked about, the church on the move, then and now. In other words, what's God calling Xenos to do? It was kind of a history. Dennis did this. And the teacher that did this did it at all. What we did it like five or six meetings, Saturday, both Sunday morning, Sunday night, then two on campus. They just ran the circuit for a week. So Dennis talked about this. So again, it's the mission, it's the vision, and how does this whole thing fit into what God's called us to do? Who is my neighbor? This Jim Leffel did this, and he talked about the disparity between the rich and the poor in the world and what God has called us to do as far as meeting the needs of the poor. Motivation for generosity. This was Gary. He talked about, he built the case, the biblical case for generosity. And then becoming a cheerful giver, I did this. It was kind of like a personal testimony and a personal perspective on how God changes somebody's life as they learn how to give. But the effect of it is that here we're praying and hoping that God will change people's hearts and get there, that the Holy Spirit would grasp them, and that they would begin to develop their own convictions. And so to this end, we had this companion prayer journal. Okay? So this was out in everybody's hands. It was available on our website. And there's six studies here, and they go along with the teaching. So there's kind of a little review, The Church on the Move, Then and Now by Dennis. And then there are questions for discussion, and then there are prayer points so that we get people engaged in the Word, and then in their discipleship or in their study groups. They're getting to many people. Not everybody uses this. Again, it's not like we said everybody in the church has got to use this thing. You know, it's like, do this if you want to. I think a lot of people used it. And so they get engaged with God in His Word on these, and then they pray about it together. My gosh, what else could you want? That and then it went right along with the studies. We keep these available because there's some good things in here that to pray about. If this is available on our website in a PDF format too, if you'd ever want to use it for anything. All of our stuff, we don't care if anybody uses. It's all everything on our website's free. But this worked out better than I think we ever imagined it would. And then, so we got the teaching series with the prayer, and then in our home churches, after the teaching series, and during this time, we're not asking for any money either. No money being asked for. We say, we're going to, and we want you to think about this, but we're not asking for any money. We're preparing the hearts of people for... I think if you ask too soon, they're not going to give as much as they might if they take some time to think about it. So then they go into, after the teaching series, in each home church, they had a short presentation, and they watched a video. And I'll just show you, this is the short version. They had a longer version. Let's see, we want to go to video and hit play. Yeah.
Something that has come back to me a number of times was how young we were when we were moving in here.
Yeah, I was 18.
A lot of people were coming to Christ, and people knew that they didn't want to be in the traditional church, but nobody really knew what begun. The thing that caught hold was a pretty simple idea of home Bible studies, where you could just get a few people together and get the Bible open and make some friends there, and that people could develop through the week relationships, not just go to a Bible study and go home. I remember this place being completely jammed.
Over 100 students.
You get 100 plus people smashed in there, up the steps, back into the kitchen, standing room only. I think one of the big realizations we made was that we needed to have a center. If you just have house churches scattered around and there's no reason for them to ever coalesce, ever come together, then they just tend to fizzle after a while. The idea of a home church planting movement is New Testament. When we get a large collection of home churches banding together into these spheres, they have enough hitting power to be able to do things that no individual home church would ever be able to do.
Yeah, the philosophy of ministry for Xenos is duplication. We want to duplicate or multiply individual Christian workers to do that. We want to multiply whole home groups. And then what we want to do is multiply what we call home group spheres, whole collections or families of home groups that have their own central teaching, their own identity, as it were.
We've got three structures that we think we need to get up right now. This expansion to the adult CT capability, where we can plant new spheres there at main campus. The second piece is Urban Concerns facility. They are spread out into multiple houses, and they need a place where they can come together and have all of this in one location. They've needed it for a long time. The third facility is a campus facility, something that will be reliable, that won't get snatched out from under us.
By God's grace, we're going to have a deep, lasting impact on the poor in Columbus. We decided 15 years ago that we're going to have a strong student ministry, which is the future of this church, as well as then the main work among the adult home groups. So it really reflects our priorities.
I had no vision for it, and when I walk into our main campus now, I still think, did we really do this? It, to me, it's an awesome thing that I see the building being used in a million ways that I had no vision for. So to me, it's a great relief that somebody had vision, because it certainly wasn't me. And the fact that it's been used so well, and that we're at a point where we need to add more space, it's confirming in a way that those steps that were made were the right steps.
The project began in 1991, and it took years for us to complete. We didn't finally move in until 1997. God pulled some miraculous strings to open up, you know, the site that we have our church at now. The growth of the church has been excellent there. Church has just taken right off, and hundreds, really thousands of people have been reached as a result.
It's like an investment. If you're gonna put your resources towards something that you know will benefit beyond what you put in. God is going to cause it to grow, but us supporting it is just going to give that growth room. I think it's like an act of belief. That it's like, okay, we do believe that this is going to happen. We're going to show that by supporting the means for it.
One of the real tangible senses that I have had, and that we've all had, is that God's doing something here. That's why I think it's a real matter of stewardship for us, because it's God who wants to do something here, and we have to basically cooperate in such a way that what he wants to do is not going to be restricted.
You know, you get to experience God coming through to take care of you materially when you're a sacrificial giver. And I think that's a lesson that's really, really precious.
All right. So I guess the thing that I wanted you to see there is how that sort of, it's just like 5 minutes, but it kind of embodies this idea that it's where we're going is what people want to support. So a couple resources here. I'll just leave this up here. I'll come back to that. But I guess I just wanted to end with, I thought I had one more slide. Oh, there it is. That any kind of giving is driven by this righteous vision. And that if, as leaders, that I guess that's what we have to pray that God will give us is His vision for the future of the church, something that we believe in, that God has given us to do, to lead towards, and I think we're going to be able to help people catch that vision. Where God leads, God provides. So, I wonder if you have any questions or comments or other things. Nothing. We don't have anything on the books for expansion because we've got we're good. We're going to use this cafe. We can fill that up many times, and we're thinking about maybe some weeknight meetings. Our campus area facility is going to be one where we can plan another central teaching down there in the adults, like a Sunday morning, and then our facility down in South Linden. We're hoping to have a central teaching and a team of, or sphere of home churches down there too. So we're good for a long time, I think. And by the time the pledges are all collected, we'll still have debt, but it's manageable, and our payments will be at the rate we're at now. Yeah, we have. Saturday night, two Sunday morning, one Sunday night, then we have one on the west side, and then we have two on campus on Monday, one on Monday and one on Thursday. No, it's different. Gary DeLashman does both Sunday mornings, and then we have different leaders for all the rest. Then I do one on Sunday morning. So... Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what we agree that is just amongst our elders that we've agreed that, you know, we're not going to be wealthy. Well, I think we're all wealthy anyway, you know, by world standards. But above certain income levels, that we want to give the remainder rather than amass wealth. No. I mean, our top elders are at 70. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then our wealthy people, we had nine donors that were 100,000 or more to the capital campaign. Yeah.
Within that, you have allow for people that want to put money aside as far as looking long-term and developing financial stability for other things long-term to give an investment, some sort of scholarship funds, and things along those lines. Mm-hmm.
That's in there. We talk some about the specifics, but we've felt like, you know, Mike, I'm a physician, and I've always tried to live. I've just felt like it's hard to really call people to sacrificial living and giving if you're not willing to, you know, be right there with them. And so that's kind of the mentality that's driven that. And, you know, my kids are going to, I'm going to help them out with college, and I've got one starting this fall, but we don't have a big, you know, college fund for him. It's meager. And he's going to go to a state school, and he's going to work, and he's going to know that he helped fund his education. Yeah.
Well, I'm not even thinking for the next, like, you know, kids. I'm thinking for, like, you know, like kids that are maybe coming out from the urban concerns.
Oh, I see.
Things along those lines. Oh, like setting up for financial giving later on.
Oh, you don't mean personal finance.
Mean personal.
You mean as the church.
Yeah.
Oh,
or
yeah.
Like, members in the church taking their own money to set aside for that and feed them.
Well, we don't necessarily advocate that they're doing that in the future, but I think as they grow, then they start doing that. Because, like, I think the one slide showed that there's over 100,000 that people give to, like, scholarships for the school, and And there are certain people that have taken students on as mentors and plan on even funding their college education. So, I mean, there's so many people with so much money. It's unbelievable. I mean, I can't believe how much money people... I mean, you could, I'm in the parking lot here, and you're like, oh, my gosh, you know? And I don't know if they're all living on, but, you know, you got all these BMW SUVs and all this stuff, and you're like, my gosh, you know, I am not inhibited at all to say, come on, you know, are we going to let the people down here, these kids go to school in a little box and drive in here in our Beamer? Mm-hmm. You know, I can't settle for it in my own life. I don't know how you can either, you know, so I look them in the eye and say it, and I couldn't. You know, if I wasn't living that way, so. Yep. Ronald Sider. It's called Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. You know, it's 5, so we'll adjourn. If anybody, I'll stick around if anyone has any questions.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.